Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, Haiti, the forgotten earthquake. A month and a half on from the devastating quake, we find out about the long-term prospects for economic recovery in one of the world's poorest countries. And making the moderate majority's voice heard. Catholics and Muslims in Cairo and Rome discuss ways of combating violence carried out in the name of religious faith. Haiti, the forgotten earthquake. That was the headline in the Vatican newspaper L'Osservatore Romano a month and a half on from the January 12th earthquake, which devastated the city of Port-au-Prince and surrounding towns, claiming up to a quarter of a million lives. Hundreds of thousands of other men, women and children have been left homeless by the quake and are now fighting for survival, many of them sleeping in the streets, struggling to find food, clean water or medicine for the sick and injured. A recent convoy of food aid from the World Food Programme was attacked in the northern city of Limbe by increasingly desperate survivors, highlighting the plight of a nation that is fast fading from the media spotlight.
I think people can put up with a fair amount of dislocation or being out of their homes for a while, but they will want to see progress quickly. And how to make it effective and how to make it also acceptable is going to be a real challenge.
Father Seamus Finn heads the Justice, Peace and Integrity of Creation Office of the Oblates of Mary Immaculate in the United States. Since the OMIs are the largest male congregation of religious in Haiti, he's travelled regularly to the Caribbean nation over the past 30 years, highlighting the need to find long-term solutions to what has been for decades the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere.
Haiti is an extremely important country for our congregation, and I've been traveling there actually since 1975 when I first went to Haiti. And so the issue has always been economic development and development that obviously relieves the serious poverty that the country, or the people of the country, have been suffering under for such a long time. So it's been a place that I have visited probably every 2 or 3 years. I know many people there, and I've been part of a number of campaigns to try and figure out what is the right development model going forward for Haiti. And of course, on top of all that, the earthquake hits. Mm-hmm. So the earthquake brought the attention, I think, of the world very clearly to Haiti as the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. And the city of Port-au-Prince just kind of bottlenecking everything in terms of movement in the country. And obviously, through the medium of television and radio and reporters, it's been graphically brought home to so many different corners of the world what the level of devastation is, whether it's 200,000 lives lost, but I think the cost in terms of the earthquake was about $14 billion. So one immediately has to applaud, I think, the great generosity of people around the world. Lots of countries immediately responding through government officials and through relief apparatus to help those who are trapped. Lots of development agencies immediately collecting money, shipping all sorts of different immediate needs, whether it's tents or water or medical care. And so that's all been a very important, real part of a response to a great tragedy. I think the question that we've wrestled with quite often with Haiti is that it has suffered under a great foreign debt burden that's been part of the reality of Haiti for a couple hundred years. And I think we continue to try and focus very clearly on the issue of the country's indebtedness, the fact that by 1900, I think about 80% of the budget was going to pay off interest on foreign loans. They are still at the moment, I think, in debt up to the tune of about $800 million. In 2008, they paid $50 million in interest. Now, there has been a number of significant relief efforts through the World Bank, the IMF, and the IDB did come up with a proposal for debt cancellation after Haiti qualified under HIPC, and that's to be applauded. And then I think the U.S. agreed to pick up some of the interest payments. But there's still, you know, I think what it points to me clearly is that the global financial system and Haiti as a country participating in that is almost locked into a straitjacket in terms of trying to plan, a strategic plan going forward to the future if they're still burdened by a principal of debt and an interest that they have to try and come up with, and then to try and include that as part of their annual budget. Now, they have much more immediate problems at the moment, but I still think that the debt issue is one that we need to focus on, and we need to lift that burden and that chain from the people if they're ever going to be able to recover from the present situation.
We had the Jubilee campaign, the Cancel the Debt campaign, back in the year 2000, and there were some important initiatives born from that, amongst which the HIPIC initiative that you talked about. You're saying, though, that it hasn't really worked, or at least for the poorest countries like Haiti, it hasn't really worked.
Well, even to qualify for HIPIC, it took a number of years. You had to go through a number of different steps that were included in the HIPIC proposal. It took Haiti a long time to get into a mode where they actually qualified for HIPIC. They did finally qualify. And on top of that, there were some significant movement by the U.S. government, the IMF, and the World Bank, and the IDB to cancel an amount of debt in 2008. The reality, however, is, after all of that, they are still heavily indebted, and the recent proposals by France and by others have been most welcome in that regard, but somehow it still has not erased the whole history of debt. Even immediately after the earthquake, the fund and the bank said, well, we're going to extend loans of $100 million. So we were immediately just aghast at this because, yes, they need money, and yes, they need it quickly, but giving them another $100 million loan is just going to pile another burden on top of them. I suspect now, and based on the press releases and the communications from the bank and the fund, they're going to do everything that they can to turn those loans into grants. And that, I think, is the right thing to do, because Haiti has such a long, long journey ahead of it in terms of any kind of rebuilding. And they need support, but they need to be accountable and transparent in terms of how they use these funds as well. But immediately giving them more loans and increasing the debt burden is not going to help them.
In a way, the work that you're doing, or the vision that you have of debt being the underlying problem here, almost undermines the work of the development agencies over the years. In other words, saying it's not going to do really more than be a drop in the ocean unless these serious issues are addressed.
Well, yeah, it is, because I think clearly, on the one hand, development agencies are committing money to whether it's education, healthcare, roads, infrastructure, agriculture. And at the same time, the government of Haiti is having to take a chunk of its budget and send it back to the very same countries that are sending this development aid in. So it's almost like a net transfer of assets. And so it's important, I think, for the sake of the strategic, long-term strategic planning and security, that we recognize that these two things are happening at the same time. And we need to be able to, when we discuss a country like Haiti and its future, we need to be honest with ourselves that this is actually what's happening. And Haiti isn't the only country, obviously, where this has been happening. But development agencies, I think, have an important role to play as well. They have expertise, they have funds. But I think they also need to say, look, you know, the government, in order to raise its budget, if it's ever going to get on a firm footing to be able to provide basic essential services to the citizens, is going to need a way to get this debt off their books. And that has to be a part of a long-term solution.
Where is Haiti's greatest need now that the actual acute emergency, if you like, is over?
My sense is, obviously, as I think the immediate needs are, just given that the rainy season is pretty close to hitting the country, is, and there are, you know, thousands of people living in tents outside of Port-au-Prince, its greatest need is, I think, going to be able to come up with an acceptable rebuilding and development plan that's going to include, you know, and listening to some of these folks who are living in Port-au-Prince. I mean, the city had about 3 million people. probably a good 50% of them are homeless in some fashion. So one could argue, well, here is a time, like it happens in any major cities of the world, to redraw the map of the city or put some new roads in. But how you do that alongside respecting, you know, longtime residents of the city and in the different sections of the city, while I think one can make a fair argument that even in the relief situation, you know, people were so dependent on the one runway at the airport in Port-au-Prince. So there were only so many planes that come in, so many folks that come in to could come in to help them. There are a number of those kind of logistic and infrastructure issues that have to be handled, and have to be handled, I think, very quickly, because it's one of the ways that people, you know, I think people can put up with a fair amount of dislocation or being out of their homes for a while, but they will want to see progress quickly. And how to make it effective and how to make it also acceptable is going to be a real challenge, because that's going to require not just coming in with a blueprint and saying we're going to put a school here and a hospital here and a road here. It's also going to have to mean figuring out how to gather local communities to say, you know, to get some of their input if this is going to be a long-term solution. We're the largest male religious congregation in Haiti. We have about 135 oblates there. Now I think there may be only about 8 or 10 Americans. The rest are native Haitians, located all over the country. We, in Port-au-Prince itself, we just simply had the provincial office and some formation houses, but we have folks down on the south side and all the way to Tiburon, up in the north side to Cape Haitian and Wanaminth. So quite extensively spread all over the country, and a couple of the members of the congregation are, one is an active bishop at the moment in Port-au-Pay, and one is a retired bishop of Cape Haitian.
How badly affected have they been by this earthquake?
There was some loss of life in terms of one of our scholastics, who was at a talk in the afternoon where a number of other young students were. Our administration facilities in Port-au-Prince have been relocated totally outside the city because there was serious damage to the building and to the communication. There is, I think at this stage, there is a sense that the rest of this academic year has been suspended, so that would be a whole semester of study. And they're trying to figure out collectively with others what to do come the next semester of school. So they have been facilitating lots of transfer of relief that has been collected in the U.S. by their families, by their friends, by the congregation. So they have been playing an active part in that. One of our oblates is in the States. He's the director of the Bishop's Program for Latin America at United States Catholic Conference. So he's been instrumental in coordinating the relief dimension for Haiti for the U.S. Bishop's Conference, and mostly therefore for the U.S. Catholic Church. He's already been to Haiti, was there for the funeral of the Archbishop, and I believe there's a delegation going back for 4 days to try and assess what would be the appropriate ways in which they can intervene and be supportive at the moment.
The church, of course, was a major force within civil society. It has suffered very badly as a result of the earthquake. I mean, how much damage has this done, if you like, to it being a voice for change?
I think it's clearly, you know, because Port-au-Prince was such a pivotal part of the country and such a pivotal part of the church in terms of the cathedral, the archbishop, the vicar general, and others, this clearly was a very, very, very severe blow to their capacity and to their work. But I think the nuncio has been extremely helpful in providing leadership, at least in the documents that I've seen, in trying to stay in touch with the local parishes and the local clergy, continuing to engage with them about what are the needs. And I think working with the Bishop's Conference and with other relief agencies, I think they certainly will have the resources and have the will to get back on their feet. I think the issue becomes clearly that you know, the rest of the country is affected by this as well, but because Port-au-Prince was such a nerve center for everything else in terms of transportation or communication, that's going to be a real challenge for them. But I think certainly there are any number of people who are working very hard at it, and so that they need to be supported and applauded for that, I think.
There has been a huge outpouring of money and services, people trying to give whatever they can to help the victims of this disaster. What do you think is the most useful thing? What can people best do as the months go on and the disaster fades from the news headlines?
Well, I think immediately, I suppose, folks have been very generous in providing financial resources to the NGOs and to development agencies that they know and that they feel that they have confidence in, that actually have an underground presence, and I think that's been tremendous. It seems to me the more long-term challenge is going to be that I know there were a lot of parishes and local communities that had a kind of a twinning relationship with different parishes in the States and throughout the world, or they had some cities had twinning relationships as well, because it seems to me accompanying the local Haitian communities in the kind of recovery from this trauma. I think I was reading some stories in the last couple of days that for many now the psychological and spiritual and emotional impact of what's happened is only beginning to sink in. They've been surrounded by such devastation and death and funerals that they really haven't had time to kind of absorb how this is radically changing their lives and radically, for many of them, just reshaping their families. So it seems to me that one of the ways is now to try and figure out how to accompany them in this journey of mourning, in this journey of redirecting or reorganizing their families or their lives or their communities, and recognizing that that's not handled just by a quick check or a donation, or whether it's of money or goods, but that takes the normal amounts of time that it takes any one of us to adjust to a new reality or to a new environment.
My thanks there to Father Seamus Finn, head of the Justice, Peace and Integrity of Creation Office of the Oblates of Mary Immaculate in the United States. Dialogue with the Muslim world was at the top of the agenda both in Cairo and here in Rome this week. In the Egyptian capital, a delegation of top Vatican officials led by Cardinal Jean-Louis Torrent held its annual meeting with the Al-Azhar Permanent Committee for Dialogue Among the Monotheistic Religions. The encounter, which concluded on Thursday, commemorates Pope John Paul II's visit to Al-Azhar University, the most important centre of Arabic literature and Islamic learning in the Sunni Muslim world. The theme of this year's gathering was how to combat violence perpetrated in the name of religion, a particularly sensitive topic in light of the massacre of 8 Coptic Christians by extremist Muslim gunmen following the celebration of an Orthodox Christmas Eve Mass in January this year.
Our Muslim partners were stressing, the teaching of the Quran on brotherhood and on respect and on common humanity. I would say that was the ground of the discussion.
A former head of the Vatican's Council for Interreligious Dialogue and expert on the Islamic world, Archbishop Michael Fitzgerald currently serves as papal nuncio in Egypt and the Holy See's representative to the Cairo-based Arab League.
It's interesting that this topic, which was one of the topics that Al-Azhar had proposed, because they were the organizers of the meeting, they had suggested 3 topics, and this was the one that the Pontifical Council opted for, and this was done last year. So it has nothing really to do with the violent event that took place in Nag Hammadi at the Coptic Christmas. It wasn't a response to that. It was actually the fact that there is violence, that where religion takes a part, whether it is manipulated or not, and people would say, well, the religions are clashing, Christians and Muslims are clashing. But it was a very topical subject because of the events that have taken place here in Egypt. And when we went to greet the Grand Imam, the Sheikh Al-Azhar, he mentioned this, and we've put this in the final document, that Cardinal Torrent thanked the Sheikh Al-Azhar for his condemnation of this violence in which 6 Christians and a Muslim policeman lost their lives, and for his expression of solidarity with the families of the victim, and also his reaffirmation of the equality of all citizens in rights and duties, regardless of their religious belonging. And Sheikh Tantawi declared that he had only done what he felt was his duty in those tragic events. But he had actually gone to the scene of the crime, and he, on a Friday, and he had preached in the mosque, and he had preached in, in a sense of Islam doesn't encourage people to take lives. I mean, Islam is for non-violence, in fact.
Do you think there is an understanding, though, of the need for the moderate voices of Islam to speak out much more loudly and clearly on these issues?
I think that there is, and one of the points that was insisted on was in education, where young Christians and young Muslims should be educated to appreciate common values. In the mass media also, that we have to be, well, we're always saying this, but we have to be more attentive to that they are not used to incite feelings of hatred one against the other. So I think there is a consciousness that, you know, a more moderate voice should be given expression.
At the conclusion of the Cairo meeting, Archbishop Fitzgerald told me the Catholic and Muslim participants drew up a list of 11 recommendations on ways of combating violence and exploitation of religion, focusing particularly on the need for a more accurate education for the young about the history of each other's faiths.
Yes, and not only the history of each other's faith, but history as such, you know, and the way that history is presented. The Crusades, how are they presented? There is work to be done, in fact, to give a more nuanced view, I think, of certain periods of history, whether it is the Islamic invasions of other countries, or whether it is, as I said, the Crusades. But there are also, I know that here in Egypt there are difficulties concerning the textbooks for Arabic language, which are very Islamic, in fact. And many people ask, why do Christians have to learn passages from the Quran and passages from the Hadith, the traditions of the Prophet, because they're learning Arabic? Well, of course, the response to that would say, but it is the Quran that has established the rules of Arabic in a way, and so this reference to the Quran is perhaps more cultural rather than religious, but at the same time, there is this feeling that the program is being Islamized rather than just a program for the teaching of Arabic.
You mentioned the 11 points in this final statement. What were the other most significant steps forward, if you like, and how difficult was it to reach a consensus on these issues?
Well, it wasn't very difficult to reach a consensus. There are certain terms, of course, that were difficult to understand. Like we spoke about the purification of memories, but I think many Christians might have difficulties with that too. But, you know, it's something that comes out of the experience, perhaps, of Christian-Jewish relations, of relations with other people where there have been a history of conflicts, and where you have to look at history instead of just repeating slogans about history, but going back and trying to purify. Now, Nostra Aetate talks about forgetting the past, but we can't really forget the past, but we mustn't let the past be a burden on us. And that's what is meant by the purification of memories. And the Christian paper mentioned Pope John Paul II in the year 2000, in the Jubilee year, asking pardon for any wrong that the Church had done in various fields. And this spirit of pardon is mentioned here as well. And I think another point that was important and that we agreed on was, you know, that to be careful to avoid discrimination based on either ethnicity or religious affiliation.
Was the particular discussion of the situation there in Egypt on this regard?
No, we didn't really go into details. I think this would have been difficult. And also, of course, we are representing international body. You know, the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue is not the particular body for for Egypt as such. So we said that, of course, as a pontifical council, it has the Holy See has an interest in the way that the local church is conducting itself, is allowed to live. So the conditions of the local church are of interest to the Holy See. This is not foreign interference, if you like, because there was that feeling also that to investigate too closely the events that take place in this country of Egypt is in a sense foreign interference. There is a great susceptibility in that, from that point of view.
Archbishop Michael Fitzgerald is the Holy See's representative to Egypt and the Cairo-based Arab League. Meanwhile, here in Rome on Monday, the St. Egidio lay community organised its annual encounter on the future of Christian-Muslim dialogue in the Middle East. The meeting brought together political and religious leaders from the Holy Land, Lebanon, Iraq, Syria, Qatar, Algeria, Egypt and Saudi Arabia. Among them was a well-known Muslim advocate of interfaith dialogue in Lebanon, Mohammed Samak, advisor to the late Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri and to the Grand Mufti of Lebanon. He talked to our correspondent at the meeting, Luca Atanasio.
Dialogue, for me, is the art of searching for the truth in the point of view of the other. This means that when I make a dialogue with you about any issue, I convince myself that I don't have the truth. This is one. Two, that I have to search for the truth. Three, that the truth might be in your point of view, which is different from mine. So I have to respect you, to respect your point of view, and to try to complete my knowledge from the differences between us. And the more I give a place in myself, in my heart, to the other, the more I understand myself. So this is done to respect the difference. Now, if we do not come into mutual understanding, at least a mutual respect for our differences. This is the theology, let me say, of dialogue, wherever they are. Now, about the Saint Egidio's initiative here, I believe it is very constructive initiative, because let me be very honest when I say this, that helping Christians of the Middle East is, for me, a Muslim, helping Muslims of the Middle East, helping Christian-Muslim understanding and living together. Muslims are really beginning, let me say, to suffer because of the Christian suffering, which is manifested in their immigration. We are beginning to realize the danger of this immigration, of the Christian immigration, on the stability, on the plurality, on the richness, and on the social, economical, and educational level of the Middle East. We are losing a lot because of this immigration. So it is in our interest. Please don't go. Please stay here. There are something troubling you? Yes, we know it. It is troubling us. Let's face it together.
Thanks there to Mohammed Samak, political advisor to the Grand Mufti of Lebanon. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. Join us again at the same time tomorrow, or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.